Today at Reader's Corner, Paul Hendrickson, author of the new book, Fighting the Night, Iwo Jima, World War II, and A Flyer's Life. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In the fall of 1944, Joe Paul Hendrickson, the father of our guest today, kissed his 21-year-old wife and two baby children goodbye, the young first lieutenant, pilot of a famed P-61 Black Widow, was leaving for war. He and his night fighter squadron were sent to Iwo Jima, where he flew approximately 75 missions, largely in pitch black conditions. In his latest book, Fighting the Night, Iwo Jima, World War II, and A Flyer's Life, Paul Hendrickson details his parents' journey, together and apart, during the war. The book offers a vivid portrait of Paul's father, whose wartime exploits were truly heroic. But his sacrifice was not without its psychic cost to him and family after the war. Paul Hendrickson is a 3-time finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, winning in 2003 for his book, Sons of Mississippi. He is the author of The Living and the Dead, Hemingway's Boat, a New York Times bestseller, and a personal favorite of mine, Plagued by Fire, The Dreams and Furies of Frank Lloyd Wright. Paul Hendrickson teaches in the Creative Writing Program at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was a staff writer at the Washington Post for 2 decades. Paul Hendrickson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much for having me, Bob.
Well, this is really just an incredible book that is timed so perfectly for me and for many readers who are trying to find a way to connect with the greatest generation. And just recently, of course, the 80th anniversary of D-Day. And here we are with a book that moves over to the Pacific Theater and to the war with Japan. This is truly a book of great depth, compassion, and incredible honesty. So why don't we just start at the beginning? Joe Paul Hendrickson, I know one of those names was dropped. I think it was Joe. You can clarify us on that. A Kentucky boy. Tell us about his roots and how he gets into the Army and winds up a fighter pilot.
Yeah, well, that's a good place to start. And I want to thank you for that beautiful introduction. I was listening and I said, gee, there's nothing else to say. We should just sign off. He covered the waterfront so beautifully and succinctly. But thank you. I'm happy to start the story where the story starts. If I could just say one quick prefatory thing.
Sure.
This is certainly a book about my father in World War II, and there's plenty of war in it. In some larger way, I feel, although there's, you could almost say humorously that the author is the last to know, but in some larger macro way, I feel World War II and this greatest generation is the secondary character, is almost the stage setting, the backdrop. The real story is a son searching for his father. The real story is a son who knew his father for nearly 60 years. And in another way, Bob, I feel I almost didn't know him at all. We can talk more about that as we go along. It's certainly a book about World War II and Iwo Jima and the mythic P-61 Black Widow, which arrived in the war very late, like my father arrived in the shooting war very late. But in this larger sense, I at least feel it's truly about a son searching to know his difficult father, whom I love deeply and was in awe of and scared of for nearly the entire time I knew him. Let's go back to where the story starts, and I won't make it too long because I have a sense already your questions are penetrating. My father grew up a sharecropper's son in the 1930s in far western Kentucky, one of 9 children. He was the 3rd born. He used to sit on wagon tongues in hay fields, baking hay fields, watching crop dusters go over. And a Ford Trimotor came over once, and the shadow of it stretched over that hayfield. It was like an epiphany, he said. He was a kid, and he knew, even before then, He was scissoring pictures of airplanes out of magazines, the Sears, the Saturday Evening Post. He told his parents he had never been out of the county he was born in. This was far western Kentucky. Rural electrification certainly had not come, no indoor plumbing. He told his mom that he was one day going to fly airplanes, and she said, Joe Paul, because they all had double names.
Here.
If you want to commit suicide, why don't you just go out there and jump off the barn? So my dad made a leap through time and space. So he had a 30-year career flying for the airlines, for Eastern Airlines. 2 decades after the war, he's flying the biggest jets that Eastern Airlines has out of O'Hare and Midway in Chicago, which is where he spent his entire airline career. I do feel that this is a heroic. My father's not Lindbergh, but this leap of the imagination through time and space from a kind of know-nothing, third-born sharecropper's boy in backwoods Kentucky, going to the war, going to the Pacific, going to 5 children in that family went to the war. My father went the farthest out into the deep Pacific and then ending up flying airplanes. So, you know, your question, I'll stop there about what were the roots of this. In 1937, outright fresh out of high school, there was no chance for college. I mean, it's wonderful that he got to finish high school.
Right.
In 1937, he enlisted in the peacetime Army Air Corps in mechanics school. And then 4 years later, Hitler's on our doorstep and the war begins in Pearl Harbor. And eventually he worked his way into flight school with his high school education. And then for the last 5.5 months of World War II, he's piloting a P-61 Black Widow on Iwo Jima. That's the canvas, the overarch of the story.
I want to make sure we devote some time to your mother as well. I mentioned in the intro that she's the mother with the 2 small kids, one of whom happens to be you. And he takes off and he leaves his wife and 2 children behind. By that time, they had traveled through something like 14 towns and various places, living on the road in the process of his becoming a pilot. But pick it up from there as far as your mother is concerned in this story, Fighting the Night.
Bob, I'm grateful for that question. This is a book about 4 male generations. My father, I'm the next generation down with my siblings, my own 2 sons, and then my grandsons, to whom the book is dedicated. Fighting the Night is dedicated to 8-year-old and 4-year-old Jackson Palmer Hendrickson and Teddy Hendrickson, 8 and 4. So it's a 4-generation male book, but man, your question is so spot on that I would like to say something about. Yeah, they were kids. They told each other goodbye in a scabby, dusty parking lot of a motor court in Amarillo, Texas on September 20th. 1944. He's 25. She is barely 21. And she has 2 babies on her hip. And they don't know at that 9 a.m. morning on September 20th that they'll ever see each other again. He has to return to the West Coast to pick up and join his unit, the 549th Night Fighter Squadron. He was given permission to accompany my mom as far eastward as Amarillo, Texas, and that parking lot is where they said goodbye. We're talking about the greatest generation, and this is a cliched kind of idea that's too easily said, but my God, I do feel each of my parents was doing something way, way above them, way, way beyond them. They were participating in a moment of history. This moment of history, and they had to throw themselves at it. They had no other choice, like millions and millions of other young couples. My mother, what did she do after that goodbye? She and another war wife got in my parents' car with the 2 babies, one of whom is me, 6 months old, and my older brother, Marty, 16 months older than I am. And they drove across however many states it is from the panhandle of Texas through Oklahoma and up into Arkansas and all through Nebraska and into Ohio to a little farm town called Xenia, where my mom was born and where she was going to wait out the war, praying every night on her knees, I'm pretty sure that she wouldn't become a widow at age 21. You know, there's a long paragraph in the book when I try to imagine what that drive was like, how scared, how tearful. She's got two little babies known as disposable diapers. Baby poop is flying all over. There are no seat belts. You're driving on two-lane roads, 35 miles an hour to observe the wartime speed limits and the gas rations and heating up the Gerber's baby food in a hot pan in a motel somewhere in Nebraska or Kansas in the middle of the night, and then finally getting to her parents 3 days later. I mean, my mother's side of this story, which I don't tell very much in the book, but my mother's side of the story deserves a whole other book.
There is no question about that. You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Paul Hendrickson, author of the new book, Fighting the Night, Iwo Jima, World War II, and A Flyer's Life. And you mentioned that word scary. Boy, that word comes at us more than once in your book, but especially on Iwo Jima. So what I'd like you to do next is just kind of take us through, first of all, what was the P-61 Black Widow, and then why Iwo Jima? And from there, we'll talk about what happens on one terrifying night on an intruder mission.
I really appreciate the progression here of the questions, and I'm hoping your readers are able to kind of follow the story semi-chronologically, but it seems to me there's an organizational plan that you get all the credit for. The P-61 Black Widow was the first operational warplane of World War II to be built specifically as a night fighter. Earlier, there had been adaptations of existing planes to convert them into night fighters. But the Northrop Aviation Corporation was given the contract and sped up. And it took a couple of years to develop this highly technical, sophisticated airplane with state-of-the-art radar sealed in its nose, a microwave radar dish that would enable the crew to be out there in the pitch of night and detect other aircrafts. The plane was used greatly in the European theater and greatly in the Pacific theater. It did not come in to the shooting war until very, very late, until 1944. My dad's squadron was activated on May 1st, 1944, in Fresno, California, at Hammer Field, which is where I was born 2 days before the squadron got activated. I was born on April 29th, 1944, and 2 days later. And then in September, my mom and dad told each other goodbye in that Amarillo lot. But the P-61, to give your listeners a sense of it, I mean, it's a glossy black airplane. It's scary to look at. It took its popular name. It was poisonous. It took its name from the Black Widow spider. Some pilots even had a red hourglass painted on the belly. It was loaded to the orlocks with armament. I mean, it was a small, tight orchestra of violence. That's the way I describe it in the book. It was a three-man crew, a gunner, a pilot, and in the back, a crucial RO, a radar operator. It's a tight ship, deliberately made sleek. It's not a fighter. No, it's not that maneuverable. It's not a bomber. It's way more maneuverable than a bomber. It's a pursuit ship. It's a fighter bomber. It's a hybrid airplane. It's a P-61. And as it's loaded to the gills, it's got this twin boom fuselage that makes it very distinctive looking. It is has four 50 caliber machine guns in a rotating turret in a the gunner sits right above my father, the pilot, and they're rotating and they can fire all 50 caliber machine guns. All four of them can fire simultaneously. It can carry 500 pound bombs under its wings. It has 20 millimeter cannons coming out of a recess on either side of the fuselage. And it can also carry rockets. My dad's did not carry rockets, but cannons, 50 caliber machine guns and bombs. And they're flying out there, Bob, in the pitch, in the middle of the night of the Black Pacific. It's one thing to be flying this plane over land where you might look down and see a spot of light to get your reckoning. But these pilots were so sophisticated. This is one reason my father was kept stateside for so long. He volunteered for night fighters. He wanted to fly the night fighter iron, is what he told me at one point in his life. He wanted to see if he was good enough. The Kentucky sharecropper's boy went all the way with his dare. So the squadron got activated at Hammerfield on May 1st, 1944. And then they were eventually deployed. It took a long time to get there, to Iwo Jima. They outfitted in Hawaii. My dad had the plane assigned to him was the Rita B. That's my mom's name, Rita B. Rita B. Bernadine. So the Rita B is painted on the nose. And then they went to, they made their journey through the Pacific. They held for a month on Saipan. And 3 weeks after the Marines raised the flag, iconically, everyone can squint and see that photograph of the Marines raising the flag on Iwo Jima. My dad and the 549th, 15 airplanes, a 300-man squadron, 250 enlisted men, 50 officers, and my dad landed the Rita B with the rest of the convoy on Iwo Jima. And for 5.5 months, between March and the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, my father flew approximately 75 missions and 175 hours of logged time.
Today I'm speaking with Paul Hendrickson, author of the new book, Fighting the Night. The book is a moving story of his father's wartime service as a night fighter pilot and the prices he and his fellow soldiers paid for their selfless acts of service. Maybe the best way to give our listeners a feel for what it was like if you were in that cockpit, and I want to remind our listeners that Paul in his book shares with us the fact that almost a third of all U.S. Marines killed in World War II died on Iwo Jima. But meanwhile, your dad, after Iwo Jima, is on what's called an intruder mission. And that's clearly the scariest part of your book. I mean, these guys had no idea what was going on. Please give us the context in that.
But as I said earlier, there's plenty of war in this book, but in a way, it's me searching to understand the meaning of this 25-year-old who could go do this thing, and this 21-year-old who could prayerfully wait out this thing on her parents' farm outside Xenia, Ohio. Back for a half a second to the plane. It's so slimmed down. You know, there's only the pilot. If something happens to the pilot, the ship's going to go down. You know, the gunner can't fly it and the radar operator can't fly it. My dad is squeezed into this tiny thing, this cockpit, this plexiglass bubble. It's called the greenhouse. That's what he used to call it. That was the nickname the pilots had for it, the greenhouse. It's got this canopy, this plexiglass canopy that slides over top of you and is latched on. And man, you're in that thing.
No co-pilot.
Yeah. Your fate is in the hands of the man who has the great poet James Dickey was connected with the P-61 Black Widow. That's a whole other story. But he has a beautiful poem, a terrifying poem called The Firebombing. And he's talking about the pilot, his hand turned blue by the power of what he controlled. a lot of the missions, in fact, most of the missions were defensive in nature. They were combat patrol. They were circling the island at pretty big distances in a pretty big loop, Iwo Jima. So, you know, the island was supposedly secure. It was not. That's a whole other chapter in the book. My dad nearly lost his life on the ground in an attack one night. 600 Japanese soldiers came out of the caves. This was after the island was supposedly secure. But they also went on what were called intruder missions. And these were to nearby Japanese controlled islands. And they would go into the ready room, the pilots and the crew, to get their mission assignment. And my dad was assigned this particular night to fly an intruder mission to Chichijima. Was 150 miles north of Iwo Jima, and it was enemy held. But they were told, the intelligence officers had said, oh, there may be some searchlights up there, but they're pissant searchlights, don't worry about them. And strafe and bomb were the orders. And my father said to me, you know, that's a whole other thing here, Bob, that these guys didn't talk about this. Only five or six times in my father's life was I able to draw him out. But the one time that he did talk about the night he got trapped in the searchlights, he said, so we were told that the searchlights were minimal. He said, Paul, I could have read a newspaper in the cockpit. He said, Paul, when I got back down on the ground, I couldn't stop shaking for a week. What happened was, he did something foolhardy, really. He circled Chichijima and he decided to fly over the island lengthwise rather than across its width to bomb and strafe. And there was a little town down there, Takanura Village, that he was going to strafe and bomb. He had just started. He had dropped down to 7,000 feet and was just starting to fly over the island lengthwise, and suddenly it was like he was like in a surgical operating room. The lights came bathing on and the ak-ak fire is everywhere, and he's going into intensive evasive action, diving and swooping and whirling. And when he told me this, his voice was raising an octave and his hand was moving wildly, trying to describe this to me. And so he over-revved it to above 400 miles. This airplane could travel, could fast, but he gunned it to above 400 miles an hour and went 50 miles out into sea, had everything blacked out, but he's 50 miles out there and he's trembling, of course. They're all trembling. And he turns on, he kept the ship black, but he turned on the radio intercom, and his radar operator in the back, who is my godfather, his name was Jack Kerr. He had stood up for me in Fresno when I got baptized. Jack Kerr comes on and says, holy, you know what, Joe, I won't use a profanity to your listeners here, Bob. Holy, Joe, what was that? My father was crazy enough, angry enough, scared enough, everything enough, that he was not going to return to base with those 500-pound bombs still dangling under his wings. So he said, we're going back around. And they went back around. They flew over the narrowest neck of land of the island, dropped the bombs. He said, I couldn't even see what I was doing. Got the heck out of there. Came back down to Iwo Jima. And he sprinted through the prop wash into the ready room and confronted his superior officers and screamed at them. You know, he could have been subject to court-martial. Screamed at them, you're going to get some of your pilots killed up there if you don't have the right damn intelligence. So that was a terrifying night for him. That was one of them.
Well, it leads me to my next question, and we are almost out of time, but I wanted to make sure that I touched upon this. One of the quotes that I picked up from your book is one of the 4 to 6 times that your father talked about his experiences. And this is so common for any of us who've done any reading about the greatest generation. So many survivors came home and they just never talked about it. And too many of us assume life returns to normal. But your father's quote was, "I was a little psycho after the war. I was hospitalized on and off. I guess I didn't know who I was. And the toughest part, I was too rough on my sons." I'll let you answer this any way you choose, Paul, but in the book, it's very detailed, and I know I strongly recommend our readers get this book. They can read the rest of it since we're almost out of time, but go right ahead.
Well, for a guy who has talked too long today, let me talk short. This quest to know my father, I'm absolutely convinced he came home from the war with PTSD. Who had a name for it? Yep. That wasn't invented yet. Right. I mean, after World War I, they used to call it shell shock, and we didn't understand it. And I think my father, he did his job professionally for Eastern Airlines, but he was working out his fear. And like a lot of fathers with a lot of sons, I mean, the belt came out, and I think that he had to work out his terrible PTSD in some ways on the backs of his two older sons with his belt. And that's a very hard thing to say, but I have it in context now. I understand it now. And this, you know, my whole life was in awe of this man and in fear of this man. I went away to a Catholic boys' seminary at age 14. I see now, and so did my older brother. I see now that we were trying to outrun our father's wrath. I think it took him a whole decade to exorcise his demons. And when the next generation of kids in our family, 14 and 15 years younger, when they came along, it was different. Oh my gosh, this is not a book about my father belting us. It is a book about me more clearly understanding how every day of his life on Iwo Jima, I think he was scared out of his skull. And could I, at 25, have done something like he did? I think no. I think no. And that's why he is an American hero, along with the fathers and grandfathers of all your listeners out there who have a common cord of memory in their own family story. I wouldn't be surprised if it's not in yours, Bob.
It is in mine, Paul, but that's not what we're here talking about. But thanks for mentioning that, because I think so many of us have relatives who came close, not exactly on point, but came close to what your dad's experience was.
I appreciate you saying that. And a book is no good at all if I just face it toward a corner and write my own story. No, no, no. It has to hit a universal note. And I tried very hard. And whether or not I succeeded, that's for someone else to judge.
Well, Paul, I can tell you right now, I read a lot of books on this show called Reader's Corner, and you've succeeded. You tried hard, and you've succeeded. This book is a must-read for anyone who wants to understand why our life today is full of the freedoms we enjoy daily and take for granted. And the reason it's like that is because of guys like Paul Hendrickson, both father and son. The father, who the son writes about. The name of the book is Fighting the Night, Iwo Jima, World War II, and A Flyer's Life. Paul Hendrickson, thanks so much for writing this book. Thanks for joining us here at Reader's Corner.
And thank you for having me.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.